Rachel, it's great to have you on the Bainbridge podcast.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So Rachel Liao is a co-founder of Fuse Inventory. And I'm excited for this conversation because this is one of the hardest areas for a lot of the companies we work with. It's a super difficult problem for brands. So I'm excited to kind of get into the nitty-gritty, get into the weeds with you about it. But first, I think it would be really helpful for you to give your background, how you sort of came to Fuse, how you came up with the idea, and then, you know, give a little bit more of the what you guys are doing and what makes you special, because you are very special in the space. So I want to make sure that comes through.
Yeah, absolutely. So I started my career in supply chain. I started my career as a software developer. And then I restarted my career in supply chain, actually, as an operations intern packing boxes in a warehouse. So it was definitely quite a jump from being, you know, a software developer doing like natural language processing to then packing boxes in a warehouse, working my way up the supply chain. So I've done everything from inventory forecasting and planning, the FP&A side, all the way down to the fulfillment in the warehouse. I've spent a lot of time in sourcing, both with international suppliers as well as domestic suppliers, working with vendors, quality control, production management, warehouse operations, kind of the whole supply chain. Wow. And when I was doing that, just did not find technology very up to date in this space. Yeah.
Well, okay, so how in the world did you, I mean, going from software developer to be like, okay, let me get into the warehouse, that's a huge change. Like what prompted that?
You know, I enjoyed coding. Like, I liked the problem solving aspect of it. I think back when I was a software developer, it was just a different time. Everyone in the room would assume, you know, I was working at companies, I was working at startups, and every time people would assume I was like the admin HR person or like marketing or like the executive assistant, even if I was like the lead developer. And I was just like really tired of it. I was really tired of not having a physical product. So I decided I wanted to do like problem solving with physical products. And so I joined a company called Kiwi Crate at the time. Now it's rebranded to Kiwi Co. And just wanted to get my hands into like, what are some problems that companies and with physical goods are experiencing? And what I had assumed going in there, you know, coming from the software side, like there would be tons of like amazing softwares, like helping out these folks in the warehouse. And turns out, everything was like paper, pencil, Excel, CSV uploads. And one of my first tasks was helping them optimize their shop fulfillment. And it was literally like someone copy and pasting from a CSV file into a label generator. So I set up ShipStation at the time, was one of the softwares that was out in the market. This is like pre-Shopify days. And so we were... Other than Shopify and a lot of the shopping cart improvements, not much has really been fixed on the supply chain side. And so, you know, you hear about robots fulfilling things at Amazon, but for your average 3PL and your average warehouse, it's very much like ship station, ship this, ship that. On the OMS side, generating labels for you, but kind of above that, you know, past order management, there's just this wide empty space of like Excel world. So we created Fuse to basically fuse all the data together. That's the idea behind the name. Get it, you know, an end-to-end system that connects from Shopify to ShipStation and that can manage your inventory, you know, everything in between that order shipping out and the order being placed, which kind of just happens in Excel these days.
All right, that's a lot. So let's like go through the sort of flow here. So if we go up for people that aren't like totally familiar with this space, So I have an e-com store, order comes in through Shopify. Now what was happening typically before Fuse?
Yeah. You know, I think the way that people thought of the supply chain before was that it was linear. People coming into the space, they think it's linear. It's like, all right, like I find a product, I develop a product, I brand it, I order it, it comes to the warehouse, and then it gets shipped to my customer. And like, at the basic level, that's what supply chain is. But I think what people don't realize is your demand fluctuates. You might have placed an order for your product and you realize it's actually a lot more popular or a lot less popular than you thought. Your supplier runs into issues getting key raw materials and the production is delayed. It's not arriving in time when you thought it was going to. And so it's a lot of actually back and forth, a lot of collaboration with various parties, whether it's your own team, your design team. Hey, can we modify it so we can change an ingredient or change, you know, a trim on the clothing so that we can get this done in time because we can't find the original component? Or, you know, hey, you know what? Hey, manufacturer, can we move production down because, you know, this product's not selling well. We actually want to prioritize production for a different product. And so it's actually just a bunch of conversations all happening at once. And then you're trying to coordinate with your marketing department, be like, hey, don't promote that item that's not going to be here in time. Or like, you know, we scheduled time to be on Oprah's Favorite Things, but Oprah's Favorite Thing isn't arriving for another month. Things like that, where it's got to be an open conversation. Like, can we swap out the good? Can we, you know, promote something else? And I think a lot of times, because there aren't systems that enable that, it's heavily reliant on like email. You know, you hear stories. I mean, my email was kept open at QVCreate for many years after I left, and I'd get random emails like on a Sunday night. Do you remember what happened in October of like 2014? And like, you know, what happened to that one shipment of like Hanukkah candles? And so, you know, that's the way that it happens today. And I think it's not as straightforward as like, I place the order, the thing arrives, I ship it out. It's really like, okay, I place the order, I need to move up POs, I need to cancel POs, I need to modify the product, I need to communicate with my customer, communicate with my marketing team.
So, yeah, I think that's a huge insight because I'll admit I've never been in operations at a brand and I had much more of that kind of linear, simple.
Founders or e-com founders, it's like their first time doing ops and sourcing. And I think the most common thing I hear like in forums and stuff is like, I didn't realize how hard it is to source good quality product and have it on time. And I think that's, the biggest like key learning. I think the companies that do operations right, they end up being the ones that, you know, last. And I think the ones that just try to like pretend operations don't exist or outsource all of it or, you know, just basically only focus on customer acquisition and not what happens afterwards to make the customers happy, those are going to be the short-lived companies.
Yeah. And it sounds like so chaotic. I mean, so now Fuse comes in. So what does, like, of all those problems you described, does Fuse solve them or which subset?
Yeah, so we do, we're primarily a planning system, but we actually just released a bunch of features around materials resource planning and vendor management as well. And so I kind of think of us as everything, you know, between, as I mentioned, between Shopify and an OMS, the ordering, the planning, the purchasing, the forecasting of the inventory, all the way until the inventory arrives at the warehouse and can be quality verified, quality checked, and, you know, deemed ready to ship to the customer. We handle everything in that white space in between. Nice. And I think that's what differentiates us from, I think a lot of times people will mix us up with an inventory management solution or an order management solution with inventory tracking, where it's more about like, how much do I have in each warehouse location? Like what gets shipped out of which warehouse, like we don't handle that. We really handle like getting that inventory into the warehouse in good condition from the right suppliers at the best possible cost, not overbuying, not stocking out.
Yeah. And you mentioned another specialty of Fuse was really around, you guys had a lot of tooling and capabilities around brands that are assembling or building or making their own products, taking raw materials into a finished. Explain why that's more complicated and hard to do.
Yeah, you know, I think as brands scale, almost every brand I see too that starts just ordering finished goods from their co-packer or their filler in CPG or even in apparel, like they're buying the finished good from the cut and sew factory. Inevitably, if you have something that's differentiating about your product, whether it's a key ingredient in skincare or like a special sustainable fabric in apparel, you end up managing that raw material. And so as companies are scaling, they need to manage those raw materials, whether it's just one or two key ones or just packaging. or they're managing every single component. Some of our clients are really key in, you know, the clean beauty space, and they really care about every single ingredient. They need to manage all of that. And so with that added complexity, especially if you have multiple levels of bill of materials, you've got, you know, how many drops of argan oil go into your shampoo, and then how much shampoo goes into the bottle, and then you have a travel size, a 16-ounce, 32-ounce bottle, and then you sell it in a pack of shampoo and conditioner. You know, that's like multiple levels of bill of materials. Managing that in Excel is quite difficult. You often make mistakes. You don't have a key ingredient at the right place at the right time to do your production. And so what we did was make sure that the platform was flexible enough to handle finished goods, as well as these raw materials, these kits and components, packaging, things like that. And we can even do like order level collateral. So like, you know, your shipper boxes, your welcome cards, things like that. Because I noticed a lot of people are just managing that in an outside spreadsheet outside of their normal inventory systems.
And you guys can handle everything to the finish. Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, bundling. Like, we actually even have like variant bundles. I think we're the only one in the space that can handle, like, if you let your customers, let's say they're choosing a eyeshadow and a lipstick, and they want to, they can choose whatever color eyeshadow, whatever color lipstick they want. We can actually do variant bundles as well and predict, like, you know, if, of the customers that buy this duo, you know, like 50% will get brown, 50% will get black of the eyeshadow, and then, you know, 20% will get red, 20% pink, et cetera, et cetera.
Wow. Okay. And so the where it stops though is tracking the inventory levels. That's one area that you stop at, it sounds like.
We do track the on-hand levels, but we're not necessarily going to be tracking like, okay, we, from the accounting perspective, we damaged this many out, or, you know, we consumed this batch so we can write off this, you know, unit cost before this unit cost. I think that's what a lot of ERP systems like focus on, and that's not what our core capabilities are. We sit on top of the systems, and then we read in the unit costs and the on-hand levels.
Got it. What, you know, if someone's not using Fuse, what would be, like, are they wasting money? Is it, like, what are some of the financial implications of doing this better?
Yeah, I mean, I think the immediate financial implication is going to be your inventory levels and how much working capital it ties up. You know, generally, generally as a brand is scaling at first, you know, if you've found a product that people love, you're going to experience stockouts. It's just going to keep flying off the shelves. You can't keep it in stock. And then what I notice commonly is people then overbuy. They're like, you know what, like, I keep increasing my buys. It only got me 3 months instead of 2 months. I'm just going to like massively buy and hope that I don't stock out because my customers are getting mad that, you know, I don't have the product. And then they massively overpurchase, and then they're sitting on inventory glut that's not moving. Almost every kind of inventory has some sort of expiration date. Even if, you know, durable goods like clothing will have fade levels, you know, skincare products, though they have long shelf lives, you know, they still will expire in 6 months, 1 year, 2 years. And so then you're sitting on this inventory glut. There's like a little like ticking in the background as you're starting to calculate, like, when is this inventory obsolete? You want to free up working capital so you can introduce new products and new shades and, you know, new styles and new excitement to the brand. But you don't have the capital to, because it's tied up in inventory. And so then a lot of people end up starting to do like discounts, things like that, which ends up hurting the brand. So I think the immediate value add is like we generally help our customers reduce inventory overspend by about 70%, and we help reduce 70%.
Wow, that's huge.
Yeah, we just published a case study with one of our customers, suit shop, and they said 75% for them. So, and one of our customers, you know, generally we reduce stockouts by like 10%, but we just, you know, surveyed Margot and they were like 40% for us. So it's really like a core ROI around your cash flow.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, beyond that, there's brand reputation, customer experience. You don't want to be a discounting brand. You don't want to be the brand that spends all of this money on like Instagram ads to drive someone to a stocked out product.
Right.
And I have core experience in that brand damage that's harder to measure, but is definitely, you know, top of mind for a lot of e-com brands.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really amazing. I mean, 70%. So what is, you said 70% inventory overspend. So are you saying like they're annual inventory spend for the year times 0.7 is.
Yeah. Or the inventory
or the spend inverse, I guess. On
products that they have overbought in. So what we actually
in our
product is measure every single inventory level and weeks of supply target that they wanted to be at.
Yeah.
And then if you're over your weeks of supply target or you're under your weeks of supply target, we're able to show that number to every single SKU.
God, that's like, I mean, so when you, somebody puts it, puts fees in, they could like very quickly see the reductions in working capital, feel more cash.
We have a weeks of supply report that literally has an indicator and it'll show you how much you overstocked for the whole business and how much you understocked for the business. And the idea is like, you're never going to be zero, right? Like you're never going to be perfectly able to predict demand and the world goes exactly the way you think. I think the pandemic has taught all of us that. But you can get better by an order of magnitude. You know, you can go from being overstocked like hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars and reduce that to, you know, 30% of what that was. And so that's really the core value out of Fuse and why we work with a lot of fast growth brands. You know, I think when you're a smaller company, just getting your footing in the space, you can get by with spreadsheets. It's when you're really scaling, you're starting to hold like significant amounts of inventory, that it really makes a big difference to reduce that glut and reduce the stockouts.
One thing that we've noticed is with fast growth brands is that because they're growing so quickly, they are often like applying the habits of a year or two ago to their current problems. Like we see it in financial modeling and planning. You know, do you see that? That like people are sort of like, oh, this is how we've been doing it for the past couple of years. Like,
we definitely see that, especially during the onboarding process when they first look at that report and they're like, wow, like we knew we had. A lot of times, even during the sales process, we'd be like, how often are you stocking out? You know, how much overstock do you guys have? And a lot of times people would be like, we know it's a lot. And like in the tens of thousands or the hundreds of thousands, but they can't put a number to it. You know, they just know they have one. And then when they hop into Fuse and they see that number in front of them, they're like, oh, it was like 750,000. And it was like 2 million. Okay. Then they really start to think about that ROI and change that behavior. Because I think unless you see that hard number, just knowing you have a problem and not like confronting it can really snowball, especially if you're a fast growth brand and you're expanding new channels, retail expansion, things like that. It's like, oh, okay. Like things that were maybe like a few thousand dollars of problem that you could ignore now are like tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands as you scale 3x.
Yeah. I wonder if like, if you could almost do like a cash, like a working capital savings, cash savings, dilution savings for the founders. You know, you're like, hey, we could have saved you like 3% dilution, you know, like,
That would be an interesting, that would be an interesting,
right? They're raising all this money and they're like, well, of course I don't spend it on inventory, but, you know, money's fungible.
I think it's the surprising, you know, spend. A lot of people are very worried because they're measuring, you know, their CAC. They're like, okay, I spent this much on ads this month. I spent this much on PR. I spent this much on CAC. What's my lifetime value? And because those metrics are so easy to measure nowadays, you know, people are looking at that, but they're not looking at their FP&A overall. They're not looking at how much is inventory costing my organization. Like, it's usually a surprise, you know, like the founder is like so busy, like getting the brand out there, getting it, you know, running that it's usually, you know, it's like an afterthought to be like, oh my gosh, actually, all my money is going to not just salaries and but inventory. And you know, a lot of times I have founders go, oh, our second biggest spend's marketing. And I'm like, are you sure? And then they like look at their documents and they're like, oh, it's actually inventory. Yeah. Second biggest spend usually is inventory, not marketing.
Yeah. And it's funny because when you were talking about like stockouts and then the other side of being working capital reductions, I was thinking like to myself, like, I bet internally the ops person fears stockouts more than over allocating capital, because like, you know, when they stock out, like you know, you're probably getting an email from the CEO, like, what the hell did you do? You know? Yes. What's going on here?
Yeah, we did an email campaign on the sales side once that was like stocking out on SKU 1, 2, 3. And then like people were like, this is not productive. You gave me a heart attack. I thought my CEO was emailing me. And we're like, okay, let's not do that campaign anymore. So we stopped that campaign. But yeah, it's when you hear from the CEO, when you get that email at like 2 a.m. is like, why are we stocked out on our best seller? How did this happen?
Yeah, exactly. So then they're like, I'll never make that mistake again. And like, you know.
Yep. But you know, oftentimes it's not so simple as like buying more. And that's why I see that problem happening where people, they're like, because they got a couple of these emails, they're stocking out, they're growing so much. They thought they ordered enough, they ordered more, and they're still stocking out. That's where you get that overstock. And then suddenly you're sitting on, you know, just a ton of inventory that's not moving fast enough. And then you have the opposite problem. And it's kind of almost something that people don't even realize until they get their next FP&A report. And then they're like, oh, wait, my accountant, are you sure you like didn't calculate this wrong? Why am I sitting on so much working capital tied up in my inventory?
Right.
And then that's when people start getting tempted with, you know, can I do discounts? Can I get rid of this somehow?
Well, that's like, and you're so right about the discounts. I mean, I guess if it's expiring, you don't have much of a choice.
Yeah. Even, you know, I was actually talking to one of the investors in Everlane, and they were saying like they had just found a bunch of inventory they didn't even realize they still had. And they had to do a massive sale because it's not like that the clothing goes bad, but it's no longer fits with their merchandise assortment. It's no longer trending. It's no longer, you know, doesn't match everything else on the website. It doesn't look cohesive. Right. And so you just end up trying to get rid of it in any way possible. And
yeah,
can, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars of inventory for some of these brands.
Yeah. You've seen so many of these operations now. Like, what are some hallmarks or common, you know, best practices? Like, what, when you, you know, what distinguishes a great ops team from like one that's just average?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it's the same as hiring for other teams. You want people who are able to see the big picture, but have attention to detail. Like, I feel like inventory planners are the most detail-oriented people ever because they're looking at, you know, like 10,000 lines of inventory and making sure every single one of them is bought properly. But they also still have to be able to see the big picture, understand where the spend is going, the priorities of the organization, how they can support, you know, the big initiatives for the organization. And I think the other thing that I think the big difference that I see from, say, a traditional retailer and like an e-com brand is some econ brands, like they'll hire like a general business analyst or a general like junior inventory analyst to manage everything, but not necessarily give like strategic direction as to where they need to invest in for the business. And I think the better run companies are the ones that hire people who have a background in inventory planning, in operations, who can maybe be that like VP of ops or have hired a VP of ops that can give that strategic direction. And it's not just someone like crunching numbers on a spreadsheet and then not like really thinking holistically about where to invest. And like, and so that's where, you know, software like Fuse also comes in, where we say like, okay, well, which products, which SKUs do you want to have a higher week's supply so that you don't stock out on your best sellers, your core products? And which ones can you maybe go a little bit leaner on? Because you may not have the budget to order everything equally. And what I see a lot is a lot of people just doing a spreadsheet with like a percentage and they're like, buy this distribution because that's how we've typically sold it. And I'm like, well, did you typically sell it like that because that's what you had available or because that was true demand? You know, like maybe you were stocked out on a period and, you know, and so a really good ops person would be like, okay, I know that, you know, we actually stocked out from, you know, June to August on our bestseller, and that's why it looks falsely low. I need to order up on that. And for our brand marketing event, but we're not running that same one, so we're not going to see a big lift in this product.
So would they go in and like gross up the stock out to kind of like what they thought the demand would have been? Or is there a way to measure
It's so painful in Excel that what a lot of companies do today is just look at the last 16, 32 weeks of sales and put like a gross multiplier to it. Like, oh, it's holiday season, like make that 60% more. And they don't have capacity, you know, especially if you're managing like 100 SKUs to go through and say like, okay, well, this SKU stocked out in this time period. And we see this very often in shoe and apparel because they're always planning at a style level and then they apply a general size distribution. And the reality is like you're by looking at the style level, you're not looking at did this style sell really low because all we had left were like extra, extra, extra small and like extra, extra, extra large. And, you know, certain styles might fit, you know, like larger bodies better than others. And so certain styles, you might actually your bestseller is a large and the other style, your bestseller is a small. And so because they're just applying like a generic sales curve across the entire organization, which again might be skewed by the fact that you weren't in stock on certain style like sizes, you know, they always get it wrong. They're not able to fix it. And so what we can do is actually tag like, okay, you were out of size medium on this style from this date to this date, and this is what we think it would have done otherwise. Yeah. And like here's your true size distribution, not just based on your historic sales, but based on what you know, your historic sales layered with data validation on top of it.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. You draw this distinction between e-com and retail in the ops people. Were you sort of implying or saying that like better ops people tend to come out of retail because...
Yes and no. I think experienced ops people come out of retail, but retail has its own way of doing things. And I think sometimes that way of doing things is not the most modern. So like some people are very married to that like 16 week average sell-through rate plus XYZ, or like a lot of retailers will be like, oh, tie it to this like one curve of this one product that performed in the past, which is like a very like, well, this blue shirt may not be like that blue shirt, but you're just using that information because that's the best you have. Whereas what we can do is like tag things, have use predictive analytics and actually say like, okay, well, blue shirts were a big part of your organization, you know, 2 years ago when you had a similar style. But nowadays, like what's trending are red shirts. And so like, even though that style is very similar, you can't really use that exact curve because your business has changed, because the style is different, because, you know, various parts about your business have changed, your demographics now that you've expanded to Canada are different, things like that. You know, and I think, so I wouldn't say that the best ops people are from retail. I think experienced ops people are tend to come from retail, but I think it's someone who, like any hiring situation, has, you know, experience enough that they can be dangerous, but not like, oh, this is the way I did it for 10 years, so I'm never gonna change. This is what I did for 10 years for your business. I'm gonna modify the knowledge I've had for 10 years and you know, make it suitable for your business.
Yeah. You know, so many brands are going omnichannel. This sounds like it would be incredible levels of complexity. What happens when you start going omnichannel to this?
That's a great question. So what we see happen, and I've actually headed Kiwi Create's like efforts into Target. And so I've worked with these retailers. I've worked with, you know, Costco, Target, Walmart. And like, I think the big difference is these large retailers, they've got a lot of bargaining leverage. So a lot of times they will give you a forecast. They'll be like, this is our forecast of how you're going to perform in Target stores. And it's from their buyers, et cetera, et cetera. But until you get sell-through data, it's all just like very like in the air, but they require you to hold that inventory. You're like obligated contractually to hold enough inventory to support their replen so that when they do want to replenish, you ship it out to them like within a certain time frame. Otherwise, you get a bad vendor score, you're not going to be promoted, et cetera. And so these retailer relationships are really tricky to manage, especially if you still, you know, need inventory to support your DTC, but you don't want to hold a lot of like inventory glut in case the retailer doesn't place that second order. And I'm not even going into all the labeling requirements, which usually causes SKU proliferation within our brands because then they have like Target specific packaging, Walmart specific packaging.
Yeah.
And so it's about being able to quickly get that sell-through data, which usually is not in the form of the EDI order that you get from Walmart. Like Walmart will just be like, we placed an order for 20,000, right? And then like 2 months later, they're like, we placed another order for 20,000. And then like 3 months later, they're like, now we want 10,000. And then 4 months later, they're like, now we want 60,000. How do you predict that?
You just get these like lump sums.
You just get these giant POs and lump sums, right? If you're lucky and or your product's already well established in the stores, they might do it every 2 weeks. So like if you get in a good cadence, they'll be like, okay, every 2 weeks, here's what we expect. And it's more or less the same. But for a lot of brands, especially when they just start, it's like huge number of SKUs, tons of working capital, and just like very arbitrary timelines and amounts.
Yeah.
So what we do with our customers is actually take a look at the weekly CSV sell-through. So like Nordstrom, Target, all of these folks, they will either email you like a CSV file from their listserv or give you a login to their portal where they will like upload a weekly sell-through report so that you can start to see what is selling through at the shelves. So you have this data. A lot of people are just like saving them all to like their box or their Google Drive somewhere and like doing a one-off analysis every once in a while. But I think what's really nice about a system like Fuse is being able to see that real time, being able to get that into a system where you're constantly looking at the report so that you can estimate like, hey, you know what, we sent them like 20,000 and they're selling through like X amount of units every week. The next PO is likely to come in on this date.
Yeah.
And you know, either more or less than, you know, the previous PO.
Right. Boy, that's a hard problem because you have to make sure you have enough to satisfy them and mm-hmm. accurately predict, depending on how long it takes you to produce or get your stuff.
Yep.
Have what
it's very different from like boutique wholesale where you're selling to like boutiques and they order smaller quantities every few weeks for like a 20% discount. These retailers are going to want like a 50% discount. They're going to want, you know, minimum X like, you know, quantities on hand at all times so that they can place a replenishment order and get it within 5 days, things like that. Yeah, so you have to get really creative.
What happens if you get it wrong as a brand? You know, you mentioned the bad vendor score. Like, can you recover? Or is like Target like, oh, thanks, guys. Like, see you later. Yeah.
It really depends. You know, I think it's two factors. One of them is like how popular is your product? How much upside mm-hmm. do they think they're going to have? How many doors is it selling through? Usually they start with a test though. And so if you fail that test, you're screwed. So most people will over order for the test. Usually the test will not, it'll be like middling, right? And then they need to expand to more doors. And then that's where it starts to get really difficult.
Say that again. So there's usually a test period.
Yeah, where it's like, how many doors are you in? Like, are you in all the West Coast doors? Or are you in like the West Coast and East Coast doors? Or like, are you in like 1,000 doors or 3,000 doors?
So if you're in like 500 doors or West Coast, you're in the test.
Yeah.
How long does that usually go for?
I mean, usually it's like your first PO and then they just see how it performs.
Okay. So you might know in a month or something.
You might know in a month or something. And that's from the data perspective. I think the real thing is with Target and these big retailers, there's also a human component. You're working directly. Oftentimes you're not only just working with a Target buyer, but with like some sort of like, I call them go-betweens, but there's an official name for them. There's like brokers that, And so oftentimes you have to go through like a licensed broker to sell to these stores. So it's like, how good is your broker? How good is their relationship with the buyers for these stores with Target corporate? That will give you a little bit more leeway, I think.
If
things go wrong, or if you notice like, hey, this test is not performing well because like you didn't put us in the area on the shelf that you said you would. Like for Kiwi Crate and on our launch, we actually went to the local Target stores that we were supposed to be stocked at. And we noticed like, hey, our products are not on the shelf they said they were supposed to be on. And we had to go back and be like, hey, you know, you said you're going to put us at eye level at the kids aisle. And like, we're at the very top of the shelf where no kid's going to see it. They're not going to, you know, have parents to buy it if it's like, you know, they can't even see it.
Yeah. And do they care when you say that? Or are they like,
That's where your broker and your buyer come in. If you have a really good one, they will advocate for you. They will call the stores. They will, you know, make sure it happens. And if you have a not so great one, you're out of luck. And you got to find another one.
It's like amazing, isn't it? How, you know, D2C is hard enough. And then you're like, here's this whole different world of these.
It's a different beast. Yeah.
Break you. So let's talk about another brand.
Much control. Like, you can't just be like, let me increase like my marketing spend or decrease it. Like, be like on the phone with someone being like, hey, please move my products up like three levels on the shelf.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, wait, I'm calling store by store to do this? Like,
yeah. And then the store manager is going to be like, what are you talking about? And you have to like go back to corporate. They have to issue a direct. It's a whole nother beast. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me about Amazon. How does Amazon differ from, you know, D2C or?
Yeah. So, well, I think when you talk about Amazon, there's FBA, FBM. And then there's also like online of the retailers, which we haven't crossed yet, which is like target.com or like, right. You know, like madewell.com. Like you can actually sell through those where it's fulfilled by merchant. It's more like a marketplace disguised as target.com. And so, you know, I think Amazon.
FBA, because I mean, let's just pick FBA. Like, does it change the kind of ops?
From a planning and procurement perspective, not so much. Because it's like you almost have like another warehouse that you're just sending things to. So if you're already operating like maybe out of 2-3 PLs so that you have bi-coastal coverage, adding another 3 PL is not a, you know, like a huge headache. If you are, however, like if you've never done more than one 3PL location or warehouse location, it could be like the first time you have to manage inventory in multiple locations. And that definitely makes it harder in Excel. And the other thing about FBA is you have to have like either your own warehouse or 3PL partner that can store pallets that go to FBA as well, because FBA will not hold pallets for you if you know, until you get a certain allocation and it's costly for them to hold pallets, but you have to be able to send them pallets, you know, as they need it so that your vendor store is good. It's kind of like a hybrid between like a retailer and e-com. And so you do need to have a 3PL that is able to do FBA pallets pretty seamlessly, because like not all 3PLs can handle that.
Yeah.
Most of them are designed for just their own pick and pack and not like managing your pallets that you send to FBA.
What's the sign for a company that like, man, we really need to get our arms around this? Is it the sales? Is it the multi,
I think a lot of times people think it's like revenue or like number of SKUs. For me, it's usually, I try to measure it as a number of complexities. So number of forecasting channels is like our primary indicator. So if you're in like Target and Costco and you have D2C and you have DTC like Canada or like Amazon FBA, FBM, like once you start to have a lot of proliferation of different sales channels, that's where your complexity increases. I think we just chatted a bunch of like different details that you have to track. But you know, it's not just the operations, like your demand for each one of these channels will be very different. The kind of products people buy, the, you know, the way you have to manage the replenishment is going to be very different. And Amazon, I should also mention like their FBA has a whole nother problem of like list hijackers who hijack your listing and have like lower quality products. And Amazon have good controls because all of them are labeled with the same barcode. So their pick and pack will just pick and pack, and you don't really have control if someone hijacks your listing and sends like low quality products. But anyways, I'm getting on a tangent there. But I think it's in the number of like sales channels, that amount of complexity. Number of warehouse locations could be another way you add complexity, or as you start to get into raw materials management, if you're just doing one or two key ingredients, it's usually not too bad. But once you start, you know, doing packaging, once you start having multiple levels of bill of materials, that's when you need something like Fuse or some sort of more, you know, high level system. And then that's when I usually see people start to buy NetSuite, but NetSuite doesn't solve all of their problems.
Right. So yeah. You guys would work in conjunction with NetSuite, it sounds like.
Yeah, we would work in conjunction with NetSuite. NetSuite will solve your like unit costing problems, your inventory tracking problems. But what it doesn't solve is your demand forecasting, figuring out like what's the appropriate levels for each single SKU that you want to be restocking at each, you know, sales channel. Yeah.
What are signs that ops has like gone off the rails? You know, if you were a CEO or founder, I mean, there's so much going on that you can sort of have conversations internally, you know, and it's like, I don't know, is it this thing? Or is it like, what are some signs that it's just gone off the rails and they need to make a change?
Yeah. You know, I think usually the first time it really comes, like, so there are some CEOs who have backgrounds in ops, and so they're keeping a close eye on their inventory at all times. Yeah. I think a lot of times people come from the branding or the advertising or the product development side, and they usually don't notice until there's a massive overstock.
So it shows up, like, they're like, wait a second, we don't have any cash left because we bought so much inventory.
Yeah, it's like, oh, we're going to launch this new product and launch this new campaign. Wait, why is our cash flow, like, not where we thought it would be? Crap, yeah. It's inventory. And I think that's usually the first sign and when we start to see people, you know, really think about an inventory system.
Yeah, that makes sense. Let's switch gears a little bit, like, to the economy. Talking on December 1st of 22. So we just got through Black Friday and Cyber Monday. Were you surprised at how strong it was, or was it
what you expected? I went into it like 50-50. I was like, it's either going to be a great Black Friday or it's going to be a like not so great Black Friday, and then we're going to have like a massive amount of like January sales and like everyone would be like very sad about their performance. I'm glad to see that it was, you know, a great Black Friday for most folks. I think a lot of times like people, you know, read the news, read the macroeconomics and start to project that into their daily lives. But the reality is like, you can only control what you can control. So you can only control your own Black Friday sales, your own Black Friday promotions, and just like hope for the best. And so I think, you know, I'm glad to see that people generally had very strong performance. And I think people were smart about the kind of promotions that they were offering. You know, I think what I did notice was a big difference between more traditional retailers and like Shopify merchants. You know, Shopify merchants obviously like blew it out of the park. Whereas like, I think more traditional retailers, they had a discount like massively. They're probably like, I see a lot of like Cyber Monday extended sales, things like that. And so it's definitely.
What drove that? Why that difference?
You know, I think when you are larger, I think a lot of brands were really smart about their working capital this year. I think they learned a lot from 2021. You know, just from what I saw in the industry, 2021 was like year of stockouts, but then a lot of that inventory arrived mid 2022 and no one was buying. And then so all of these, you know, e-com brands had like a ton of inventory just sitting on their shelves, like in June, July, wasn't moving. They just doing summer sales of like winter clothes, you know, things like that. And so I think they got smarter and were a little bit more conscientious of like what kind of inventory they were investing in. And we saw that with our own clients as well, you know, like, okay, we're going to really invest in the core SKUs that we think are going to perform well and not just like buy across the board. I think when you're larger and you have more capital and you're not forced to be as scrappy and, you know, when you have a lot more pool, so like Target, Walmart, those folks were able to get their inventory, you know, in time for Q4, Q1, because they could rent container ships, because they could do things like pull up, you know, their vendors and make sure that the vendors serve them first. And so they didn't go through as painful of a learning as a lot of the e-com and like younger brands did.
Yeah. Yeah. You guys have such interesting data sets. You must have your customers in aggregate must have a view of what 23 is holding. You know, do you see indications that they think it's going to be good, or are people kind of worried? And
You know, I think there's always, and you know, because I talked to a lot of founders as well, there's always worries about the macroeconomics. Like, I'm sure you and I worry about macroeconomics as well. And I think it's about, and I think what I can offer to our clients is that real-time visibility that they can actually stay on top of their numbers, be able to detect the first signs of things not performing well and be able to change it then. But I think what we've seen, and so far at least, is that business as usual. Like, we had a strong holiday performance so far. I think it'll continue to be strong. I think, you know, people are still willing to buy things. There's, you know, Christmas is still there. I feel like there's a renewed emphasis on family since the pandemic, or people are gathering. And so I think what we're seeing is people are already placing their POs for, you know, Chinese New Year and all of that. Is that it's business as usual, but always with an eye out of any changes, any indicators that you need to react quickly to. And so, you know, if you don't have that good reporting yet and you're a founder, you need that reporting because you need to be able to react quickly. But you don't want to, like, if you don't buy inventory, you can't sell anything, and then you will, by definition, not perform well. So you don't want that, right? You still want to be able to purchase and run your business like it's going to perform well. Otherwise, you shoot yourself in the foot.
Right.
But you have to be ready to be able to adapt and trim down if, you know, you see those signs. And so that's really kind of what I've been advocating for our clients and what I've seen.
That's interesting. How do they think of it at a high level? Are they thinking like days inventory on hand or day sales, or like what are some of the metrics that people are using to know if they're right sized and they're buying?
Yeah, so generally we use weeks of supply, and we use a forward looking weeks of supply rather than a backwards looking. And so what I mean by that is like 10 weeks of supply during the holiday season might be 10,000 units. 10 weeks of supply during a low selling season might be like 5,000 units or 2,000 units.
Okay.
So always keeping that forward-looking weeks of supply helps you right-size your inventory amounts depending where you are in the year.
Okay.
So
you're doing it seasonality. Interesting. Yep.
But being able to do it at a SKU level, I think a lot of times people just kind of look at their, because of the lack of granularity or the, you know, your Excel can only have 10,000 lines and you have all these variants and color waves and things like that. Being able to do it at a granular level and be able to like bucket, like, okay, certain core products, I'm going to have a higher weeks of supply because they're my best sellers, they're my most profitable products. I don't want to stock out on them. Maybe some seasonal patterns, you know, seasonal scents, seasonal fragrances, you know, can be a little bit leaner on. And so I think and then you can also adjust that ratio based on what you're seeing. So maybe something that was an underperformer before is starting to become really hot. It's trending now. You can then, you know, quickly increase that weeks of supply target for that product and maybe lower your weeks of supply target from some other products that aren't performing as well. So having that flexibility and the ability to react quickly at a very granular level is what I've been seeing with our clients and what I do advocate for a lot of founders.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Rachel, anything else? Did I miss anything?
Oh, I mean, I can talk about supply chain for hours, so we could keep going. But, you know, I think we've talked a lot about the best practices, kind of like going into the next year. I think the only other like major theme that I have for folks is just, you know, paying attention to the global like geopolitics. I think that's going to be huge in, you know, the upcoming months, upcoming years.
Are you saying specifically there? I mean, what is?
Yeah. So I think, you know, I think in general, I think the biggest one on the horizon is, I think all eyes are on China right now. What that's going to look like. You know, I think previously we saw Brexit during the pandemic. So if you were sourcing from the UK or selling to the UK, there were huge headaches around customs there. And, you know, you saw Russia invading Ukraine, what that did to gas and to wheat and to a lot of things that are sourced from, you know, Eastern Europe. Eastern Europe has a lot of, you know, good industries that where you can get like high quality but reasonably priced manufacturing, and so a lot of folks source from there. So, you know, that's going to be, I think, a continual concern as you start to see like, you know, blackouts and whether or not the aggression, you know, accidental missiles accidentally hitting Poland. That, you know, there are a lot of Eastern European countries right next door that supply like, you know, key products to a lot of customers, and so that's going to be, you know, on the radar. And, you know, anything that's changing in the world is going to be focused on. But I think China is probably the biggest one in people's minds because, you know, we've already been in a trade war with China for many years. I think a lot of people with the pandemic forgot that we started a trade war with them in like 2017, 2018, and we're still in a trade war with them. And that's unlikely to stop. So we're seeing a lot of the inflation comes from a lot of costs being higher due to that trade war. So a lot of production moving to Vietnam, Cambodia, things like that. But I think if there is ever any sort of like armed conflict over Taiwan, I mean, semiconductors are just kind of the tip of the iceberg. I mean, that obviously affects a lot of companies like Apple. So, you know, our economy, that'll be interesting. But, you know, that means you cut off access to, you know, maybe even India and Pakistan because of the uncertainty around the freight containers in the Pacific Ocean. And so there could be huge ripple effects there. And so I think one of the things I've advocated even pre-pandemic was vendor redundancy, being able to have multiple vendors that can source similar products.
Yeah.
It's something that I'm hoping will be more in people's conversations. Cause even before the pandemic, like I remember getting a postcard from Function of Beauty and they were like, we can't ship any shampoo this holiday season because our one factory in Houston, like there was a hurricane and we can't ship anything out. Yeah. Like, you know, it's like stuff like that, where it's like, if you only have one vendor and any sort of even not geopolitical, but climate change related action happens, you know, if you were sourcing out of Indonesia and then now you probably can't source out of that region and that was your one supplier, then you're kind of screwed. And so having that vendor redundancy, something, you know, maybe a lower cost further abroad where you can, you know, take advantage of those cost savings, but maybe something also closer, you know, that nearshoring, reshoring initiative. But I think from a practical perspective, you know, being able to ramp up things faster, maybe producing high demand volatility products closer so that you can ramp up, ramp down, like really trendy products, but you know, that the black t-shirt that always sells, you can always just produce that at a better cost, maybe further away. So I think that's the other big theme that we're going to see in 2023 that I think, you know, should be in people's conversations and people's radars a little bit more.
Man, this has been awesome. Thanks, Rachel. Yeah. This has been a terrific, it's like a tour de force of insights and supply chain and ops wisdom. And it's been fun for me. This is not an area that I ever get to go in much details on.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to talk supply chain for hours. So always happy to chat about supply chain anytime.
Cool. Well, thank you, Rachel.
All right. Thanks, Ben. It was a pleasure.